Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
It's another in our occasional series on the music venues of a bygone era. We call it Vanished Venues.
We're calling to the faraway town. A war is declared, the battle come down. London calling, it's time to be tough. And phony Beatlemania, put in the dust.
In past editions of this series, we've looked back at the Palladium and the old Metropolitan Opera House. And the legendary Village Gate. We've strolled through the Greenwich Village of the past to visit the Bottom Line. And Gertie's Folk City.
Oh, Paul and Silas are bound to deal.
So yeah, we've done a fair amount of these Vanished Venues programs. Just not 3 days after the venue closes. But that's what we're doing today. Electronic music producer Dan Deacon was part of a four-night send-off for the music venue known simply by its Brooklyn street address, 285 Kent. Their final night was this past Sunday, though the party didn't actually stop until well into Monday morning. New York Times pop music critic John Caramonica was there and wrote about the closing of 285 Kent in Monday's Times. You can read it online at soundcheck.org. And John's on the line with us now. Hey, John.
What's up, John?
Well, you tell me. I mean, New York has always had its share of, let's say, semi-legal music venues.
Sure.
Going back to Prohibition. What made 285 Kent different?
The thing that always jumped out at me about 285 was this kind of, it never felt quasi-legal, even though it very much was quasi-legal, verging on illegal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things about the DIY community over the last, I don't know, say 10 years in Williamsburg is it's been getting more and more formalized. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't like to talk about. But, you know, there's a big difference between seeing a show at 285 Kent, which had security, which gave contracts to the people who were playing, just like any other corporate venue would have an artist sign a contract. There's a big difference between that and what was going on at, you know, early Market Hotel, Shea Stadium,
mm-hmm.
maybe Death by Audio, although I think Death by Audio maybe secretly is a little bit more organized than it comes off as.
These are definitely DIY,
others,
and we're stretching it to say they're semi-legal. Is that what you're hinting at here?
I think each building has its own particular set of problems. Obviously, you know, there are the cops can come and shut you down if they so choose. 285 had an issue where a health inspector had come. 285 did not have a formal liquor license. They did sell beer, but they did not have a formal liquor license. So I think each building kind of came with its own set of problems.
But you write that, you know, in the article that the owners of 285 Kent, the people who were running this, actually did try to make it into something that, to all appearances, was a legit music venue, to the point that they even installed air conditioning. Which,
yeah, that was one of my great moments of show reviewing was the summer of 2012. I mean, come on. You know, I reviewed, you know, anywhere from 1 to 5 shows a week. And in the middle of the summer, you know, you see the calendar and you're like, oh, that's a good show going on in such and such a space in Williamsburg. And oh, I'm going to sweat for 4 hours. It's going to be brutal. And then I remember I showed up. I can't remember what show it was, but I showed up at 285 for some show, and I see these glorious things hanging from the ceiling, and I, you know, made a point to purposely, like, stand right under where the blast zone was. And I was just like, oh, it's magic. Oh, it's magic happening on Kent. But yes, they were trying. In short, they were trying. And they had a vision, and they had an organizational skill that I think was slightly further down the road than some of those other spaces.
So what were the problems, ultimately, that made it impossible for 285 Kent to continue?
Well, I think there's some things we know about, and there's some things we probably don't know about. I think the things we know about is, look at where 285 Kent is. This is Kent off the corner of South 2nd Street. That block, or that stretch of blocks on Kent, you look at that stretch, say, 5 to 10 years ago, it's largely abandoned. There's no residential towers. It's sort of a free-for-all of a two-way street right up against the river there. You look at it now, directly across the street, I think they're building a new residential tower. A few blocks to the further south is a huge residential complex. A couple blocks north is a very, very fancy new supermarket. Time and money was going to catch up to them. I don't think that that's exactly what was happening, say, this month. But, say, within 6 months or a year and a half, time and money was going to catch up to them. I also think that what you're seeing is part of a bigger picture of Williamsburg changing and these spaces wanting to become official, or other official spaces that have the character of a DIY space, maybe taking some of the energy away from the actual DIY spaces.
Right. It's worth pointing out 285 Kent was not the only music venue in the neighborhood or even on the block.
No, not on the block. I mean, it's right next door to Glasslands Gallery.
We're speaking with John Caramonica, pop music critic for the New York Times, who was at the final concerts of the music venue known as 285 Kent. And, John, they did go out with a bang, didn't they?
I mean, it was a fun night. I mean, one of the things that you could always sort of count on at 285 was a really energetic crowd, and bands, I think, always really responded well to the space. It's sort of a big empty warehouse, effectively, and I think bands enjoyed the mild chaos that you could create in a space like that. It didn't feel sort of as confined as a traditional venue.
And sort of headlining the final night, which was Sunday night,
right,
was the band that, for radio purposes, when they played here in our studio, we simply called them Effed Up.
No friends of the New York Times copy desk, I will say that.
or of the FCC, but let's hear a little bit from them. Music from the band that we'll call Effed Up for the moment. They have played here in our soundcheck studio. They played the final night at the music venue known as 285 Kent, which was at 285 Kent Street in Brooklyn. John Caramonica was there on closing night and wrote an article for the New York Times about it. You can read it at soundcheck.org. And there was a connection to Lou Reed at 285 Kent somehow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the good things about how 285 Kent shut down, which is in this very orderly fashion, is it allowed for all these sort of memorial pieces to come out, you know, both mine and also people who had done more histories of the space. And one of the things that came out in a couple of those pieces is the prior incarnation of that room was for a sort of performance collective that had been founded by someone who had previously been Lou Reed's personal assistant or music assistant, something along those lines. And they had found the space initially. That person found the space initially, I think, sort of as a maybe a gear storage place for Lou Reed or a mm-hmm. sort of semi-practice space for Lou Reed. But ultimately, it did not become that. But the person who found it ended up taking the lease regardless, making it a performance space, and then ultimately turning over the lease to the people who turned it into 285 Kent as we know it now.
And so 285 Kent as a music venue, as a DIY music venue, you date it to late 2010. So basically we're talking about a 3-year run. Is that unusually short, unusually long in DIY terms?
I would say it feels short to me. I wouldn't say it's necessarily short in DIY terms, but it's short in the sense that I think it had an impact in a very quick turn. And that's something that was attributable to the fact that the people who were involved with managing and booking had a tremendous amount of experience. Mm-hmm. These were not people who this was their first thing that they were doing at age 17 or age 19. These are people who I think were able to hit the ground running. Now, an interesting thing about 285, you compare it to sort of other venues that are maybe more closely associated with a particular sound.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think you're not going to see as much both generationally, because it's not like CBGB at the height of punk. It's not like, you know, any number of hardcore places, you know, your Coney Island High hardcore shows or anything like that, or metal shows. But because the sound of kind of young, cool New York, for lack of a more artful way of putting it, because that sound is actually a more diverse sound, mm-hmm. what you saw at 285 Kent was a fairly diverse set of bookings. I mean, I've seen hip-hop there. I've seen dance music there. I've seen metal there. I've seen, you know, fake 90s grunge revival there. I've seen, you know, traditional indie rock. I've seen basically anything you can see in that one space. Now, you can argue that that means it didn't have an identity, but I actually think that that's much, very reflective of what the average, you know, 18 to 23-year-old kid who's trying to be cool and is interested in new music, that's what their palette is like. Yeah. And 285 reflected that.
Listeners, what do you think? What will you miss about 285 Kent? Or what do you think about the DIY scene as it's currently constituted? Post a comment on our website, soundcheck.org, or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. Again, we're talking about the recent demise of 285 Kent, which joins the list of vanished venues that we've talked about on Soundcheck over the years. John, I want to play a song for you, especially because of the first line we're going to hear in this song. This is from one of my favorite bands on the Brooklyn music scene. The group is Parquet Courts.
I was walking through Ridgewood, Queens. I was flipping through magazines. I was so starving. Myself, should I eat this? I was so starving. I was scratching off silver ink. I was deciding what to drink. I was so starving. And I was walking through Ridgewood, Queens. And I was flipping through magazines. I was so starving.
Just a little bit of the song Stoned and Starving by the band Parquet Courts. John Caramonica, it opens with that line, I was walking through Ridgewood, Queens.
Sure.
Is that where the DIY scene is? Is it just like, is all of Brooklyn now so priced out for these folks that that's where it's going?
I wouldn't say all of Brooklyn. I mean, Ridgewood has the benefit of basically being just on the other side of the Brooklyn-Queens border. So I wouldn't say it's that all of Brooklyn is priced out so much as you look at sort of the patterns of gentrification of young kids, and you look at, like, basically where the L train goes and where the G train, you know, where the trains take you, and you always sort of go one or two stops further out. And Ridgewood is a more logical follow place than, say, you know, Bay Ridge or Sunset Park.
Right.
But Ridgewood certainly is a neighborhood that I think is in turn right now, or having its turn. I'm interested to see if actually people are going to return to Brooklyn and start moving sort of, you know, Crown Heights, Brownsville, East New York, or Sunset Park, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I'm curious about for the next 3 to 5 years. Because you're getting to a point with Bushwick where a lot of, I mean, obviously there's plenty of stuff that's yet to be turned in Bushwick,
mm-hmm.
but it's happening at a faster clip, and frankly, real estate development is speeding up, and it's catching up to where the kids are going. So you don't just have a situation where it's young kids who are looking for cheap spaces where they can throw shows or have art galleries or whatever. You also have real estate developers who are like, oh, that's where the young kids are. Let's get in there, knock that building down, and build a residential place there. Those are starting to catch up. And this is another way in which the professional and the underground are intersecting, except in this case it's real estate where they're intersecting. You have the pros and you have the indie kids both fighting for the same spaces.
And right now that's in places like Bushwick and Ridgewood.
Absolutely.
Is there anything really new in this story, though, John? Hasn't this always been the case here in New York?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons you can't get too sad about it. I mean, I'm sad in the sense that that's a place where I saw a bunch of good shows and I know as well. I mean, look, as someone who spends a fair amount of my work life going to concerts, I like to have places that I feel are reliable, places that I trust, bookers that I trust, venues that I trust, places with an aesthetic point of view. So obviously you want to mourn when one of those things goes away or one of those people goes away. But no, the scene doesn't exist in a place. The scene doesn't exist in a room. The scene exists in the energies and passions of the kids who bring it to those spaces. So ultimately, we'll be doing this again 3 years from now or 5 years from now about some other space that I haven't even been to yet.
Right. John Caramonica, pop music critic for The New York Times. He wrote a piece for Monday's edition of the paper detailing the close of the music venue 285 Kent. You'll find it on our website, soundcheck.org. Listeners, what do you think? What will you miss about 285 Kent? What do you think of the DIY music venue scene? Post your comment on our website, soundcheck.org, or leave a message on our voicemail, 866-939-1612. John, nice talking with you again.
Likewise. Solidarity, man.
This is Soundcheck. Thanks for listening. Stay connected by subscribing to the Soundcheck podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and download the new WNYC mobile app for free. See you next time. I'm John Schiffer.